Welcome to the Happy Being Well podcast, where we talk about strategies and insights so you can live happy being well with your host, Rita Ferrugia. This podcast is presented by happybeingwell.com, your online store providing the best in all-natural wellness products, such as natural essential oils, all-natural bath products, all-natural facial masks, all-natural deodorants, irresistible leggings, crystals, including crystal home decor and kitchen items, herbal teas, natural sleep aids, and so much more natural wellness goodies at happybeingwell.com. Free shipping on any order within the USA at happybeingwell.com. Now enjoy the show.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of Happy Being Well. We have an exciting guest today. You know, she's not your typical executive coach because which I love because she actually infuses spiritual intelligence in her coaching, which is super, super needed in today's culture. So she is Dr. Robin McKay. She's an authority on spiritual intelligence. She's a top advisor to high-level executives and leaders at Fortune 500 companies. So I'm really, really excited to have you on the podcast, Robin.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm happy that you're here because usually, you know, with coaches, they're always so focused on, you know, strategic and the organizational developments and, you know, maybe communication. Like, I never really hear infusing the spiritual component, which I, for one, it's like so needed. It's actually a part of organizational success because people negate to like recognize that we are human beings with a spirit and emotions that, you know, are a big part of you know, cooperation and communication and to get things done. So tell us, like, how did you start on your journey and what made you infuse the spiritual component into your executive coaching?
Well, I was born that way, first of all, but I want to share with you something that happened in 2020 that really has set the tone for the last couple of years of my work in the corporate space and in entrepreneurship too. I think that we can always infuse more of our spirits into the work that we're doing in the world and how we're contributing. But back in 2020, I live in Arizona and it was March. So it was right before everybody got sent home basically for the pandemic. And I was in yoga class one Saturday morning. We had a substitute teacher who I'd never met before. She taught a pretty good class. I was laying in Shavasana at the end. And you know how yoga teachers will often do like a meditation or they'll extend some of their own wisdom or something during that Shavasana. That's what she was doing. And I was kind of in the zone with it until the moment that she said, "And just remember, you're just a cog in a great machine." And I was like, my eyes popped open and I was like, what did she just say? That was the strangest thing I've ever heard a yoga teacher say in my life. But it's also, I'm grateful for that moment because that was a moment where I really got to drill down into what I actually believe about people, people in organizations, just people in the world, is that we're not cogs in great machines and we're not robots and we're not clones. We are living, breathing human beings who have spirits, who have intuition, and it's time that we start using those elements of ourselves that have been kind of put on the back burner, especially in the corporate space for years and years, being called too woo, too touchy-feely, which I'm kind of used to at this point in my life. But it is one of those things. I think we've got a lot of work to do in the corporate space in terms of allowing people to bring their full selves to work. So that's kind of where I got my start really talking about and anchoring into the spiritual and intuitive aspects of what it means to be a leader, what it means to be just a person who's on a mission to live our best lives.
I love that. And I mean, that was one of the things that I saw when I was in corporate. It was, you know, I mean, just endless meetings on, you know, how, you know, we can, you know, maybe there's not enough results in a certain area and, you know, and like so many times, seeing how people's egos get in the way of actually really just looking at the truth of the matter to actually get the results. Like if they, people were just able to actually have that emotional intelligence to actually seek clarity, like, you know, productivity and results would just easily just go through the roof, because it's really just simple. Like, I mean, I've sat in so many meetings where I'm just like, because I can't really say anything. Sometimes it's not my place, because maybe I'm just sitting. I was always the marketing girl, and I had to oversee different departments and learn, and so I can market better. So I was never my place sometimes. But I literally would just sit there as the observer, taking my little notes, and just it would pain me to see people in so much pain. Just due to the whole, no, I'm right. No, I'm right. Well, I want this now. I can't do this right now because you're not letting me finish my process, the project that prior, that project is contingent upon that project being done. You know, stuff like that. It was just, nobody was really hearing each other based on a myriad of emotional factors, ego being one of them, perhaps other emotional components at play due to the person's personality or maybe things going on in the time. So what do you do? I mean, that's a really complicated, you know, to be able to isolate those variables on an individual level to come in and create a cohesive harmony in an organization. So how do you do that?
It's really hard to untangle, isn't it? And you did such a beautiful job illustrating not just the process of it, but just even the energetics of it, the competition and the egos and the infighting and all of those things that can take place, supposedly in the service of what's best for the outcomes, for the productivity, for the programs and whatever they're offering and whatever they're creating. But ultimately where I've landed, and this goes all the way back to when I was in grad school getting my PhD in psychology, when I really started looking at the role of positive psychology in organizations and how important it is for us to feel our best in order for us to perform our best. In fact, that's one of the foundations of positive psychology that we see in the research, is that there's a causal and bidirectional link between happiness and success on any number of variables, including productivity, including success variables in business, raises, promotions, and so on. So what does that mean? It means that happiness or well-being creates the conditions for success to arise, and then success creates more well-being and happiness. So you get on this beautiful upward spiral. So I rarely will go into an organization and immediately hit them hard with spiritual intelligence or even intuition. Where I really start is back with the emotional intelligence and the calibrating our own emotions to be at a higher frequency, to be at the frequency of well-being, to be at the frequency of a zest for life. We're not always going to be happy all the time, and certainly happiness is fleeting. But when we start looking at how can I feel good enough, how can I feel better about what I'm doing, about just even in my physical body, how can I feel better? That's going to change the tone of the meetings. And I also bring in mindfulness into the conversation as well. Just think about that meeting that you were illustrating. If everyone were just being mindful, paying attention on purpose with open hearts and without judgment, how would that change the conversation? How would that change the outcome? How would being mindful breed a level of success that just isn't possible when there's so much ego playing with each other in that same space?
Love that. Awesome. So you're saying that if we're happy in a happy state, we won't be so tied or attached to our ego?
Well, kind of. I think that ego is always going to be a part of it. I don't think that there's anything bad with having an ego. We all have it. But I think that a lot of us get led around the room by our egos. We get led around life by our egos. And one of the markers of ego is competitiveness, is being judgmental, is being overly concerned with what other people think about us. And a lot of times it's self-protective. Mm-hmm. And so when you're practicing, I don't always think that happiness ought to be the goal, because happiness, as I've said, is fleeting, but to cultivate a deep sense of love and satisfaction with yourself and with what you're doing and the contributions you're making, you have a different relationship with the ego, so that your spirit is actually in charge. You know, Einstein is credited with saying that intuition is a sacred gift, and reason, or the ego basically, is supposed to be a faithful servant. But we've created a culture that honors a servant and has forgotten the gift. So when we move back into that mindfulness and paying attention on purpose and being open-hearted and non-judgmental about whatever we're experiencing, we're actually allowing the spirit, the intuition, to flow back in, and the ego, the intellect, to take its rightful place as the servant. It's not meant to be in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
We have a whole lot of barking dogs in the egos that are running around pretty undisciplined, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think a part of it would be self-awareness, like a lack of self-awareness, and just letting your emotions of the need to feel significant totally hijack your system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be able to see the clarity, just see how things can be super, super easy. So many endless meetings I would sit in and just like, oh my God, this is just so easy, guys. It's so easy. It's so simple. Why are we letting egos or, you know, getting, it's always, for me, I think most of it really was ego. If I'm rewinding all those meetings where it's just endless meetings over trying to get literally something accomplished and amongst various individuals, I would say always the common denominator would be ego. Sometimes miscommunication. And also the way people attach meaning to certain tasks as well. So I remember, because I'm a personal development junkie, I'd always try to facilitate peace within the organization. We're always needing a certain task completed or deliverable by a coworker sometimes in order to get a project done. So the way people sometimes assign meaning to a particular task, you know, sometimes it can get vague, murky. Like, oh, it's your responsibility. And this is strategy. So you do that. It's your job to provide the strategy. It's my job to provide the creativity or the graphic or whatever it is. So what's the strategy? No, you. And then I remember sitting in like this huge conflict over what they thought was strategy and whose role it was to provide that. And so I just literally started asking questions. And then they realized what a ridiculous conflict this was. And all she had to do was just prep the graphic girl, the head of the creative director, just what was the purpose of the graphic, right? So sometimes it's really just different meanings they're assigning to a deliverable sometimes.
Sounds like a fifth grade social studies project that you had to do with a group. You know what I mean? Like there's that level of, and listen, this is not the case for everybody, but there is a level of psychological maturity on teams that's really required. And that comes from also good leadership and somebody holding the vision and carrying the vision for the team as well. And if there is no vision, boy, it's really easy to get lost wandering around in the forest sometimes. And so when you, for example, are a voice of reason and you're able to come at it from a mindful, curious, introspective angle, that changes the conversation entirely, and it untangles all of that perceived confusion that people might be experiencing. And confusion, I think, is one of the number one unnecessary experiences that we have as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what do you do to provide clarity in, you know, the state of confusion within an organization? Because there's a lot of confusion going on sometimes.
I know. Not my circus, not my monkeys is what I've heard a lot. Well, you know, I have always said, whether it's an organizational or individual, whenever somebody's confused, it's usually because we know what we want but we're not allowing ourselves to say or do the thing that we want. And often I find, you might find this too, but I find with a lot of times with women especially, we'll say that we're confused when we're actually not confused. We just need a little bit more clarity on something, or there's something that maybe is unclear, that a piece of information that is required in order for us to move the needle on whatever the project is that we're working on. So the number one thing I teach about getting clarity over confusion is to remind yourself, I'm not confused. I'm not confused. And then the next thing you can do is just ask yourself, since I'm not confused, what do I need right now? Mm-hmm. What do I need right now? That just brings you back into the moment, the mindful moment where you can look at things from a different angle or a different perspective. And usually after you ask those questions, something will arise, but you don't have to use the word confusion to describe that you need more information on something. You can just say, I need more information.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can just say, what do you think about X? I would like to, if I could, eradicate the statement, I'm confused, from our conversations. I think that would go a long way to just providing clarity for next steps or for what the vision is.
Mm-hmm. I love
that. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. Asking the question, what do I need, activates, you know, the resources, mm-hmm. to see the resources that we can tap into to get going and knowing what to do.
It activates your imagination. It activates your intuition. You get to see things from a different angle. But the first thing, and that's personal responsibility. Talk about personal development. Personal responsibility is, am I really confused? Am I? Check in with yourself on that. And if you are confused for some reason, it could be, you know, in our world, there are a lot of opportunities for us to tune into people who maybe don't have the purest and highest intent, that are intentionally creating a state of confusion. I feel lost. Well, are you really? Or is there something external to you that may be creating the conditions for you to question yourself or to gaslight yourself?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. And in your experience, you know, what area of an organization is typically the most confused? Is it roles and responsibilities? Is it, you know, how to structure the team meetings? Is it, you know, me perhaps the communication flow within the organization, like how people are communicating, whether it's through a particular project management software or relying on emails, maybe relying too much on the verbal communication and not enough email? Like, what mm-hmm. is the typical most problematic area of confusion?
Well, I always have to look at, is it the vehicle or is it the people? And usually it's, and this is nothing, I mean, listen, I worked in corporate for a long time and I know what it means to be, you know, kind of have miscommunications or not know where things are, not know where we're going and feel confused or feel conflicted about something. So I get that. But I think the more of the inner work that each individual person is willing to do on themselves in terms of leading themselves, in terms of not waiting to be spoon-fed. I learned this a long time ago from a mentor when I was in the corporate space. I worked in biotech and pharma for a long time before I got my PhD. And she said, you know, I'd rather ask for forgiveness than ask for permission. And I thought that was such a good way. At the time, I was probably 25 and wanting to ask permission for something. And she's like, why? You know, take the initiative and take responsibility for your decisions. And then you can say, I'm sorry if you screwed something up. And that was one of my first lessons in leadership, actually. Rather than waiting for permission, obviously, I know that there are times you have to be discerning about that as well. But when each individual person is taking personal responsibility for leading themselves first, making the shift out of being, you know, in very kind terms, a worker bee, just, you know, somebody who, a cog in the machine, and owning your part of it, even if you're not really quite sure what that part is at the time, you can usually get to the solution more quickly when you're taking self-leadership than when you are waiting for somebody to tell you what to do. So there is that initiative that we have to start cultivating and continue to cultivate in our careers. And then I had something else come through and I can't for the life of me remember what it was. So I'm going to pass the ball over to you and see what came up for you as I was sharing that.
It happens sometimes. So what's the ingredient to an organization where in your experience, like one of the key ingredients or key ingredient of an organization that you would be like healthy and there's like high solidarity amongst the team members and, you know, people are really like rooting for each other and they're really getting stuff done, you know, and getting results through, like, what are the key ingredients to that?
I think that's a leadership issue. Here's where I land on leadership. A leader's role is to carry the vision. My dad always says, whoever carries the vision leads the way. So the leader needs to carry the vision, set the tone. So if the leader, for example, is up at 3 a.m. in the morning checking emails and sending out, you know, frenetic messaging early or late, that's setting a tone for the team. It's creating something that is going to probably be felt as dissonant energy. So carry the vision, set the tone, maximize team members' strengths. So to be able to see what the team members' strengths are and place them in roles where they can be successful, where they can be stretched. There's not a whole lot for the leader to do in terms of getting down in the weeds, rolling their sleeves up and getting to work. It's more about who they be than what they do. But that beingness is so important. And that's where that mindfulness piece comes in. I think that when leaders really have that quality of self-awareness, and other awareness too, that emotional intelligence is such a big piece of the leadership puzzle right now, more than ever before. You know, in the past, a lot of times people got promoted into leadership positions because of something that they did technically well. Like they were the best technical expert on the team. But being a technical expert doesn't necessarily make them good people leaders. It makes them really good technically, but they may not have the emotional intelligence in order to be able to lead a team well. So we have to also start looking for rising leaders. We have to start identifying emotional intelligence, spiritual intelligence as two of those ingredients that are going to make a huge difference now and in the future in terms of where teams go, in terms of harmony within team, in terms of productivity and innovation in teams.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally, totally agree. Some leaders though, you know, when they, maybe because they started the company small and they were just so used to doing everything themselves because they became an expert in many different areas. Now they have a team, because I've seen this myself. Mm-hmm. Not all, but some do. And, you know, they're very admire. I mean, it's a very admirable quality to have, but they end up like literally becoming the brains behind everybody's job roles because they're just so used to that and they can't let that go and they mitigate so there I remember being a part of an org where like I don't know how he got all this energy but he like literally was like constantly eyes and ears on every single account and project and making sure everything was running smoothly. And if there's a gap, he would jump in and he would be the brains for that gap. And he just took the responsibility for everyone's basically played. And it's kind of like removing their ability to solve the problem, right? Because he's not allowing them to figure it out. Because he just wants everything to be like successful. But the thing is, it's like, then when he gets burnt out and then you're spoon feeding your team so much, they're just kind of used to that. So they're not developing their muscles to be able to solve problems. So when he steps back and he just expects them to do it and the ball drops, then he gets disappointed. How do you solve that?
I'm smiling because you describe that so perfectly, especially with leaders who are scaling, who have gone from the solo practitioner or the solo business owner to having, and their business blows up and now they've got this whole team and they don't know what to do. Again, to the point about the technical expert who builds something to a certain level and then it's time to hand it off. That is a developmental growth stage right there. that is really making the shift from individual contributor into leadership. And unless and until people really embody that leadership energy, the spirit of their leadership, and understand that they can't, I mean, they can be micromanagers, but it creates a lot of pain for themselves and for the business. And to your point, what happens when they burn out and the ball drops? Because the people who they've hired haven't been empowered in the past to solve problems. Not that they can't, but it's it doesn't bode well, I think, for the future of the organization when a lot of the team members feel like they've got their hands tied because somebody's in charge micromanaging. So that's something that we have to work on personally and privately with the leader, him or herself. I think that that's the most important thing. It's one thing that when I work with leaders, often they want to do this behind the scenes and behind closed doors because they do need a place to process what's going on for them and their frustrations and their insecurities and their self-doubts. Those are all things that are going to come between them and their greatest sense of well-being as well, because we want them to be at their best. But one of the ways that they can stop themselves from being at their best is by kind of swimming in that sea of uncertainty, self-doubt, and over-control that often accompanies that transition from a solopreneur or solo business owner into scaling the business.
Yeah, I love that. I totally agree. And it's just a byproduct of just being so used to doing it yourself and being in that. Mm-hmm. Just a conditioning.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great myth. That's the great mythology, right? That I'll just do it myself. It takes me a shorter time to do something than it would for somebody else to do it. I mean, I've gotten caught in that too. I love doing graphics on Canva, but is that really the best use of my time? Really, Robin? No.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see? Yeah. And so I've had to, over the course of my own business development, had to let go of some of the things that, of course, when you're doing it yourself for the first time or because you're on a budget or whatever, that is a reason to. But at some point, when your business gets to a place where it's outgrown you individually and it actually is asking for more people to come on board to support it, to allow it to grow, allow it to evolve in the direction that it wants to go as well.
Awesome. And when a company is just scaling like that, a big problem they have is streamlining operations. What is the first thing that you tackle in order to structure an effective streamline for that particular organization?
Well, we always have to start with the individual, right? The leader first, to look at what are those things that you can take off your plate immediately and why don't you want to? And who's going to take that over? It's really, you know, on a meta level, it's about defining new boundaries and roles and responsibilities and allowing those roles and responsibilities to evolve with the business rather than stagnate or even slow down the business growth. So in terms of streamlining, I think that it starts with the mental game, the mental and emotional game, actually, more so than like any kind of physical process. We have to look behind the scenes and see what's going on, what's stopping you from streamlining.
Mm-hmm.
And get at that piece. And then usually the 3D, the physical reality catches up as soon as we clear that out of the mental emotional field.
Awesome. And love that. And I was going to ask, you know, what's one of the key ingredients to effective cooperation, but I think you already answered that with, you know, it's really about the type of leader. It really falls back on the leader, because essentially the leader really is creating the culture of the organization, because everyone's looking to the leader, how the leader is acting, communicating, you know, mm-hmm. It's kind of like the father or the mother of the organizational family.
Yeah, I mean, there are four questions that I ask any team member to answer, including the leader. What's your greatest hope? What's your greatest fear? What can we always count on you for? And the hardest one to answer is always this: what do you need other people on this team for? Because, you know, we get trained from the time we're little kids to not need anybody for anything. And that's that kind of rugged individualism that we are moving away from as we are continuing on this ascension path, but it just, it is one of the hardest things, is to be able to say out loud to your teammates, to have that level of vulnerability or openness to say, you know what, I actually need somebody to do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And well, does that make sense? Like those are, those are the four questions that really get at the heartbeat of any kind of team growth and development.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that totally makes sense. And it also too, you kind of have to audit the leader's experience. I mean, there's some leaders who've sometimes never actually had a job before, right? They finished university or college and they built a business and they were in there and it scaled and they just don't have that experience to what it's like to work with other people in a professional capacity and how putting themselves in the worker's shoes they don't have that, the eyesight or the foresight to understand those dynamics. And then some leaders do. They've had plenty of corporate experience, so they kind of understand what needs to be at play when you're managing people at work. Which I'm sure you audit and you have to.
It reminds me of that CNBC show, Undercover Boss, where the leaders of big organizations go undercover and work with the boots on the ground people to find out all kinds of things that were completely unexpected or they were unaware of from their top level position. And we're talking about big organizations, but I think that there's a benefit. And I think that every leader needs to know the role, know kind of what's going on. You don't have to be a master of it. That's, you hire people who have mastered the elements that you're wanting to develop and advance in the organization. But, to know the roles, I think, is important. And that is, it's a good point around auditing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Awesome. I love this conversation. It's one of the reasons why I developed happybeingwell.com is because I wanted to provide an environment in the work that really kind of embodied the more of the spiritual, emotional components so that people can literally be empowered and have more harmony in the workplace so that they can like bring harmony home. I think people fail to recognize how a domino effect, the particular type of workplace you work at has this massive domino effect in society because it affects your mood when you come home and how you show up for your family, your children, your spouse. You know, it's just, and then the kids get, it's just this huge domino effect. So it's always been a passion of mine to provide, really healthy, harmonious workplaces. I feel like that's one of the heartbeats of our society.
Mm-hmm. It is. We're always going to be working. There's this, I like the thinking though, that work can be more about flow and less about hard work, grit, tenacity, all of those kind of old school pre-2020 mindsets. And attitudes have really given way to things like optimism and intuition and flow and creativity and all of these ideas and practices that you and I both know are the most effective ways of moving the needle on any kind of innovation or any kind of business opportunity. And yet, it's a hard lesson to unlearn too, the grit, the hard work, the tenacity. When you build a life based on those qualities, it can be difficult to let go of, but I think the intentionality of what you're doing with the podcast here, with what my clients and I are doing in terms of shifting gears out of that old gerbil wheel style of working, that cog in the machine, recognizing that we're actually not, we're human beings, we have emotions, we have intuition, we are spiritual beings living a human experience. These are the great gifts that we have to advancing our world and to creating a world that we most want to live in, rather than one that, is sort of artificially laid upon us because of old work ethic or old generational and genetic influences that no longer are really relevant or necessary.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think a big part of it is that I think in our culture today, there's so much more tools that are being exposed to us. I mean, look how many podcasts today are talking about mental health or stress.
I was so happy about that. So happy.
Me too. In books and in seminars and events. And I mean, it's just being talked about more so in the mainstream culture than ever before today. So I think, you know, people are, I think it's leading to more of a self-awareness where if we look at our culture, I mean, looking back at the culture, even the 90s, it was so toxic. Like we allowed people to be mean. Like it was like, we just kind of, people were just being mean and it was just never like being called out. It was just like, we just kind of like,
Accepted it. You said the 90s. And I was just remembering that that was when I had just started my career in biotech, and it was right, I forget what year it was, but it was right around the time where sexual harassment had really come on the scene as something that was not appropriate in the workplace, but we had really started turning that corner. And I remember I went to my HR rep in my company one day because they were doing an info session on sexual harassment, and that it was called sexual harassment training. And I'm like, can we maybe change this to like sexual harassment awareness training or something? Because it just feels a little bit too aggressive. Like I'm training people in sexual harassment. So we've come a long way since then, but we still have a long way to go in the corporate space in allowing people to bring their whole selves to work, allowing people like you and me who are emotionally intelligent, who are spiritually intelligent, to be that without judgment, without being told that we're too much or that we're too woo or that we're too touchy-feely. Usually that has more to do with the person who's saying that than anything that I'm doing. I'm just being myself. But there's a comfort level that I am seeing a shift into with spirituality, with mindfulness practices in the workplace that is very positive, and I'm looking forward to seeing what continues to evolve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I worked for a really, a top digital marketing agency, and it was very high pressure. And so I decided to, you know, there's a lot of stress. It's a very stressful environment, at times. So I decided to incorporate meditation into the organization. Because we had a spare room in the organization that really wasn't being used. So I like, you know what, during lunch, I'm going to run a meditation session. Anybody who wants to come in during lunch, you're more than welcome. People showed up. It wasn't a lot of people. It was like, yeah, it was mainly girls.
All five of you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was very like minority, because a lot of people thought it was woo woo. They're like, meditation. Nah, I'll pass. So it was very minority. I think there was like one guy and maybe like five or six girls, maybe, you know, seven.
I'm so glad you did that though. That's a precursor to what's going on today with mindfulness practices and organizations and all of the online resources that we have now available to us. I read recently that mindfulness practices in like 3 years are going to be like an $8 billion industry. So we're finally on the right path. We've been on the right path for a while. We're just seeing the adoption of these practices coming to the fore now in the mainstream. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful.
Yeah, no, it really did help though. Mm-hmm. Even though it was a small group, they kept coming back to mm-hmm. every session yeah. during lunch. And then what happened was there was more harmony amongst us in the, you know, when we all, you know, it's a marketing agency, so we all have different accounts and such. Sometimes we work together, sometimes we don't. But when we did, it was our communication increased. The effectiveness of our communication increased. There was more harmony in that interaction. And also people got addicted to it. So whenever we had flexibility in the organization in terms of our time, like they didn't monitor, like, you know, when we came in, when we left, or when we took, it's like, as long as you got your work done, everything was cool. So I would have a tap on the shoulder, like, hey, can we do a meditation? Like, right. I'm like, okay, sure. Because she would like be like really like she saw it as an effective outlet to release stress so she can return back to work fully recharged. So it was cool.
Mm-hmm. So good. Well, and then what we know about meditation too is that it creates a ripple effect. So when 3 or 5 or 10 people are gathered and they're meditating and they're focusing on their breath and they're focusing on harmony and objectivity and curiosity, that has a ripple effect on the entire organization. So you made a way bigger difference than just those six people. It was like everything that you six people or six or eight people touched were affected by your state of consciousness, your state of being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a gift. That's the gift of meditation.
Mm-hmm,
for sure.
Absolutely. And just one more question out of curiosity.
Sure.
A big part of ego is, you know, the need for significance. And I think that's a big driver. I don't think the need for significance is such, I don't know, but it's big of it as a significant. So is there any ways to kind of gain that need, like a feeling of significance without focusing on the self so much? Is there any way for somebody to still get that without, you know, being such a, you know, kind of being like a, as if they're the only one on the team, like they're the all-star player mm-hmm. that doesn't want to pass the ball. Is there mm-hmm. any way to?
Well, if you're the all-star player that doesn't want to pass the ball, then we've got to have a private conversation about what's going on behind the scenes there. And a lot of times that's a pretty deep dive because there's a lot of self-preservation and the intellectual arrogance, is often founded in a lot of things that have gone on since childhood, actually, just to get on the psychological path for a second. If you're somebody who plays on a team with an all-star player like that, that's really a painful thing too. And it's something for leadership to take a look at. Is that really the best team player? Probably not. But for most of us do want a level of significance. We want to be recognized for what we're doing. Self-recognition is as important as other recognition. In fact, I think that self-recognition is actually has a lasting effect. In other words, if somebody else gives you a gold star, you might believe the gold star for a couple minutes. You might appreciate the gold star for a couple minutes, but then you might start doubting the gold star. Well, maybe I didn't deserve the gold star. Well, who are they? Maybe they're just, you know, letting me be a little bit precious for a moment, right? So there's a lot of inner work to do around deservedness and worthiness when it comes to full expression of your contributions and the things that you're here to master. Because ultimately, that's, I think, what all of us want. We want to make a contribution that matters, and we want to master some things as well. So when we kind of sidestep the old understanding of what significance is, the externals, it's not, I appreciate that I've won some awards in my work. Of course, I appreciate that recognition. But I also know what happened behind the scenes for me to be in a position to receive those awards fully and embody them. It's different if you receive an award for something and then you can't really take ownership of it, that you're embarrassed or you're a little bit ashamed or you're a little bit too modest or whatever it is. It's no big deal that I've gotten this award. So there's this misapplied and misidentified relationship with recognition, with awards, that really, again, it goes back into that sense of worthiness and deservedness. Worthiness, am I enough? Am I enough, actually? And then deservedness is, have I done enough to deserve this award? And that is not something that I can do for you. It's not something that anybody can do for you. You have to do that for yourself. That's a self-examination piece. That doesn't mean that you can't work with somebody to support you in increasing your levels of deservedness and worthiness, but it starts with the inside work.
Love that. So Robin, where can people learn more about you, ways to work with you? Where can they go?
Go to my website and take the quiz. I've got a leadership styles quiz, and this is one of my favorite ways to help you understand who you are as a leader. Because the more you understand about yourself as a leader, the easier it is for you to do the things like actualize your greatest hopes and dreams and be effective as a leader, is to understand what your leadership strengths are. So go take the quiz, drrobinmckay.com/leadership quiz. That's a great place to start. You can also find me on social media, Instagram, it's dr.robinmckay, and on Facebook and on LinkedIn too.
Awesome. Love that. So guys, take her quiz. Do you have any downloadable freebies people can download?
The quiz has all kinds of stuff attached to it. So that's the great place to start.
Awesome. So guys, go to drrobinmckay.com. Take advantage of her quiz. And thank you so much, Robin. I really enjoyed today's conversation. It was really enlightening. And I'm sure everybody learned a few nuggets today and some gems of insight. And everybody, if you enjoy this podcast, if you haven't subscribed, subscribe so you don't miss another episode. And remember, live happy, being well. Until next time, guys.
If you learned something new or were inspired to live happy being well, please be sure to subscribe to the Happy Being Well podcast so you don't miss an upcoming episode. Also, please feel free to leave a 5-star review, including what you learned or what inspired you in today's episode. This podcast is presented by happybeingwell.com, your online store for natural wellness products so you can live happy being well. Order your next all-natural essential oil, all-natural face mask, all-natural bath soap, all-natural deodorant, herbal tea, crystals including crystal home decor and kitchen items, irresistible leggings, and much more at happybeingwell.com. Free shipping on all orders within the USA.